We hope you enjoy this recording of a live broadcast brought to you by Torah in Motion. For more learning opportunities, please visit www.torahinmotion.org.
Good evening, everybody. I'm Jay Kelman, and on behalf of Torah in Motion and the Yeshiva University Kol HaMitzion Zichron Dov. Dov, of course, is Ellie's father, Alav HaShalom, and Sher Shemaim congregation. I want to welcome you all tonight to the book launch of an Italian Renaissance, which is a fascinating work, and I'm really honored that Ellie has chosen us to be the conduit to do the book launch. And we started talking about the book about a year ago, and I told him at the time I found the pieces he had sent me were amazingly interesting, and that when the book is published, we'll do a book launch, and here we are, and it's really a pleasure to be here. Before we start the formal part of the program, so to speak, Ellie wants to read a little bit from the book, just give a brief introduction, then we'll start. What we're going to do is I'm going to ask him a series of questions on the book. Have a discussion, and then at the end we'll open the floor to questions from the audience. I highly recommend you buy a book, you know, sooner rather than later, because I assume they'll all sell out. But when you hear what's in the book, you'll all want to buy it. So we only have a limited edition, and to the best of my knowledge, they are not yet available in Canada. I don't believe the books are yet available. So Eli Vakasha, and thank you very much.
Thank you, Rabbi Kelman. I'm thrilled to acknowledge the presence here this evening with us, the heroine of the book, my dear mother, Mrs. Judith Rubenstein. I'm going to do two readings to begin with. The first has to do with my mother. It's in her honor. And the second one is in memory of my late father. Judith lay exhausted in bed, her newborn son snugly bundled beside her. The maternity ward of the Ospedale Maria Vittoria in Torino, Italy, was a large room packed with women and babies. The cacophony was deafening. Some of the women were in various stages of labor, shrieking, "Mamma mia!" at the top of their lungs. Others had already given birth, and their babies, in bed with them, yelped shrilly, filling in the upper register of the chaotic chorus. It was hardly a tranquil place to recuperate, but Judith was so thrilled about the wondrous event she had just experienced that she barely noticed the din. She could not possibly have imagined, as a prisoner at Auschwitz, that a mere 3 years later she would be privileged to bring a Jewish child into the world without fear for his safety. It was early spring in northern Italy. The windows in the maternity ward had been flung wide open, and the aroma of blooming roses wafted in from the hospital's garden. Spring, rebirth. Judith was seized by a sense of promise for the future. The hospital staff had already affectionately labeled her son Piccolo Polacchino, Little Pole. They made the rather reasonable assumption that any foreigner to be found in Torino those days was of Polish origin. Despite the fact that she was obviously not Italian, the staff treated Judith no differently than the others. This in itself was astonishing for someone who had not long before been harshly mistreated simply because she was Jewish. It seemed there were still good-hearted people left in the world. Perhaps her despair had been premature. Perhaps there was hope for mankind after all. Yet, as she glanced around the room on that glorious spring morning, Judith was reminded of her desperate loneliness. She knew not a soul in the hospital. Her son had been born on a Friday afternoon, shortly before the onset of the Sabbath. Her husband, Bela, had to leave the hospital while she was still in labor in order to make it back to Gruliasco before nightfall. He did this out of respect for the Sabbath, on which he was not permitted to travel. He also did it out of respect for the curfew, requiring all refugees to be inside the camp's walls by 8 o'clock every night. That entire day, neither Bela nor anyone else who would be interested knew for certain that Yudit had given birth. She yearned to share her joy with those she loved, and she was deeply saddened by the fact that she could not do so. At this special moment, when she became for the first time a giver of life, Yudit ached with longing for her own mother. Since childhood, I have struggled to understand my father. I am not referring to the man of the recent past, for he is someone whom I came to know very well. The man of the distant past is another matter entirely. As my father hardly ever spoke about the earlier part of his life, almost everything of the little I do know concerning this period has come to me from indirect sources. Reflecting back on the years I was privileged to know him, two rare instances of my father opening up about his past stand out in my memory. The first related to his unusually youthful appearance, a consequence of his rosy-cheeked, virtually wrinkle-free complexion. I once mentioned this to him and was quite surprised by his explanation. In April of 1943, he was in a Munkatábor, a forced labor camp on the outskirts of Budapest, working in a munitions factory. One day, the air raid siren sounded, signaling an imminent attack by enemy aircraft. Before anyone could take shelter, a large bomb came crashing through the roof. It ignited the phosphorus supply and sent a searing flash of fire through the plant. My father lost consciousness and fell to the floor. He was taken to a hospital in Budapest, where he convalesced for many months. The explosion of the bomb at close quarters had punctured his eardrums, while the phosphoric blaze had burned off all his hair and turned the skin of his face totally black. This skin eventually peeled off, exposing a baby pink new epidermis. Thus, my father explained his youthful-looking face. It was as if, in narrowly cheating death, my father had one part of his physicality reborn. An eerie foreshadowing, perhaps, of the spiritual renaissance he was to undergo after the war. The second uncommon glimpse into my father's past was provided several years ago. We had gone to the neighborhood synagogue to hear a respected Talmudic scholar speak about the meaning of the Holocaust. The learned rabbi expounded upon the classical Jewish idea that when God permits calamity to befall the children of Israel, it is because they have been sinful. In his view, the Jews of Europe must have angered God very badly, and the murder of 6 million of them was the catastrophic consequence. The rabbi suggested that perhaps these people had not been sufficiently scrupulous in their performance of the commandments. Visibly agitated, my father rose from his seat and left the room. For someone who was generally a paragon of courtesy, such an act was quite out of character. He explained to me afterwards that he had reacted sharply to the suggestion that the murdered members of his family were responsible for their fate rather than the Nazi murderers. He found this notion obscene, As my father saw it, someone like the guest speaker was only able to express such a warped view of things because he had the good fortune to survive the war in the safety of his American home. Any Jew who had lived through the hell of wartime Europe knew better. Such fragments, an anecdote here, a sharp reaction there, are all my father ever conveyed to me directly regarding his past and how he felt about it. It fell to my mother to provide me with a key piece of information about my father, which radically transformed my understanding of him. Shortly after I turned 16, my mother took me aside and told me she had something important to tell me. It was very difficult for her to talk about it, but she wanted me to hear it from her before I heard it from some stranger. I didn't know what to think. Perhaps she was going to tell me that I had been adopted. No, that was not it. She revealed that my father had previously been married with two young sons. He and his family lived happily in Sentishvan, the village of his birth. During the war, he was drafted into forced labor by the Hungarian government, along with many other able-bodied Jewish men. He was working in a munitions factory when the Americans dropped a bomb on the building, and he was gravely wounded. While he was recuperating in a hospital in Budapest, drifting deliriously in and out of consciousness, his wife and children were deported to Auschwitz, never to return. He was completely unaware of what had happened to them until he was able to go home at war's end. He never fully recovered from the terrible tragedy of losing his family. What made the tragedy painful beyond bearing was his sense of failure as a husband and father, and his irrational feelings of guilt at not being present to protect his loved ones when they desperately needed him. I was in shock. I ran to my room, closed the door, and started crying uncontrollably. Later, I would wonder, what was it that upset me so? Was it grief over the murder of my stepbrothers and their mother? Was it a son's shared experience of his father's pain? Or was it perhaps the realization by a sensitive young man that his own father was in some ways a stranger to him?
Thank you. You know, just by way of introduction, I think the honor that Eli brings to his parents is one that it takes a rare child. The book is such a thoughtful, a respectful, and really an extremely open and honest account. And I know Eli is a man of truth, and that's one of the things that strikes you at the book, the honesty and the openness. So just to begin our conversation, I just want to ask you what motivated you to write the book, and why especially now? It's a few years after the passing of your father, and how long has it been in the making?
Well, this book has been a very long time in the works. It didn't start as a book. It was reflections as I was growing up on the background and experiences of my parents, to the extent that I was aware of them. Overwhelmingly, what I knew was from my mother, who was the communicative of my two parents. My late father, as mentioned in the reading, didn't talk about his experiences before the war, during the war. And in that, he was quite typical, quite representative of Holocaust survivors from my experience. But this is something that was a part of me as I was growing up. I didn't think back then that I would write a book. But at some point, I started taking notes, jotting pieces of thoughts down, and over time they coalesced. I received encouragement from a number of people I knew and respected greatly, who told me that I really should put it together in coherent form, develop it, and make it available to a wider audience. And I did that, but since this is not my day job, it took me a long time to do it. I've been working on this off and on for, I would say, about 8 years. Usually, I would sit down after midnight when it was finally quiet and there were no distractions, no phones ringing, no one looking for me. And I would usually work between 12 and 2. That didn't mean that I got to sleep in the morning. Just suffered sleep deprivation while I was working on this. But I finally got it done. There's no particular significance to the timing of publication. Once you're in the hands of your publisher, you're totally at their mercy, and there are all kinds of things that go on and don't go on that you really can't control. It just so happened that it took until now for the book to get published. That's a story in itself, which is for another time and place. It just happened now, nothing more than that.
Could you briefly give a description of your parents' life before the war, their growing up, the type of Jewish life they lived?
Well, I don't want to take away the reason of the good people who came here tonight
briefly,
to read the book, because I do deal with that in the book quite extensively. Very briefly, both of my parents grew up in pre-war Hungary. My father in a small peasant village called Szent István. It was a very simple life. There were only a handful of Jewish families, and they were of necessity well integrated with the surrounding population, although everyone knew their place and the Jews kept to themselves. They lived a traditional Jewish life, but it was a very balanced, very moderate kind of Yiddishkeit. No fanaticism to it whatsoever. My mother lived in a larger town called Szerencs in the east of Hungary. It's a mid-sized industrial town with a much larger community, an organized community, with all the institutions that you would expect to find in a well-developed Jewish community. It was an Orthodox community, but again, it was quite moderate and balanced. And people worked, they made a living, and went about their lives like people everywhere. And it was a good life. I'm certain that neither of my parents would have ever left the places they grew up in if not for the terrible events of the war that turned their lives upside down.
What I found one of the most interesting things in reading the book was how little time you spend on the Holocaust itself. Basically, a description before the war, years in Italy, the 3 years you spent in Italy, and then when you came into Canada. That was clearly intentional in the book. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
It took about 2 decades for what we call Holocaust literature to start to appear. It was only in the mid-60s that Elie Wiesel published Night and other works started to come out. By today, there's a veritable torrent of literature relating to the Holocaust, a great many memoirs, and God forbid, I don't want to denigrate them. Each one of them is sacred, and there can never be too many of them. There's a sense of desperation and urgency to the creation of additional such memoirs for the obvious reason that there aren't that many survivors left, and fewer by the day. And it's a limited opportunity. But that's something that has been well attended to. I couldn't do that anyway for the obvious reason that I'm not a survivor, thank God. I'm only a child of survivors. So any story that I have to tell is a different one. I'm not the person to write about what happened during the war, even with regard to my own parents. Again, in the case of my father, I know virtually nothing about what happened to him during the war. I just know that it was a pretty terrible experience. In my mother's case, I know quite a lot, and I mention a few things in the book, but I didn't want the book to be about that. The book has a very clear focus. It deals with the process of healing and regeneration of survivors after the war. And that's an area where I feel there's a need. There simply hasn't been very much at all written on that subject, I hope that my book will be a modest contribution to filling that gap, and I hope that there will be a lot more to follow. But it was quite deliberate not to denigrate the telling of stories about wartime and about the Holocaust, but because my focus is the period after the war.
The book itself was called An Italian Renaissance, implying that it was your years in Italy that really laid the groundwork for the life in Canada. So I want to describe the importance of the 3 years, really, the family spent. You were born in Italy, of course, and how that served as the bridge between, you know, Europe and Canada.
Well, one of the ideas I grew up with was what I heard over the years from my dear mother about the curative effect of the time that the family spent in the displaced persons camp in Italy. They were dreadfully unhappy about being there. It was no one's choice to be there. They would rather have been anywhere else in the world. But in retrospect, their being in the camp did serve a useful and a beneficial purpose. It prepared them for a normal life after the total lunacy of the war years. Now, that's not to say that it was necessary. It's not to say that they couldn't have found their way without that. Obviously, a great many survivors were not in the displaced persons camps. Some were, and tragically, their lives didn't turn out so well. The camps didn't have a curative effect for them, quite the contrary in some cases. So there are no hard and fast rules. I can only talk about the immediate experience of my own family. That's what I know about. You can generalize to some extent, but I'm not going to claim that all survivors had to go through this kind of intermediate process. It's obviously not the case.
The book itself is a wonderful testament to your parents' life in Canada, how successful they were. You, on more than one occasion, you say beyond their wildest dreams, the success of your parents and the family. And maybe if you want to spend a few minutes to describe how unique you feel your parents are as relating to other survivors and what the secret of the success they had in Canada.
Well, when you talk about succeeding beyond their wildest dreams, I think they were pretty typical of people who survived the camps and came through those terrible years intact. Their objectives and their aspirations were really quite modest. They wanted simple things. They wanted to be left alone, to live in dignity, to work, to support themselves, to get married, to have children, things that the rest of the world takes for granted, but things that were great acts of courage for these people and were not at all to be taken for granted. That's all they wanted, to live a normal life. And they didn't know what lay ahead. When they were in Italy in the camp, they had no idea where they would end up. They would have gone anywhere. As it turned out, the first opportunity, fortunately, in retrospect, was to come to Canada. But that things turned out as well in Canada as they did was really a stroke of good fortune that they never anticipated back then.
You mentioned in the book how formal Jewish education, you implied it before, was not a was only a minor force in the identity of your parents. And you yourself state that you have a certain degree of skepticism about the notion how important the formal Jewish education is in transmitting our values to the next generation. Ask you, especially in the context of the world we live in today, especially in the Orthodox world, what exactly has happened, why there's been such a radical change, what's the fallout, and what would you do, if anything, to shift the focus? And do you think we are failing or succeeding in our mission?
That'll take at least an hour, I think.
Okay.
If I can do it justice to it at all. I'm going to be in serious trouble with a lot of the people in this room if they get the idea that I'm not in favor of Jewish education.
I'm also a formal Jewish educator, so it's okay. But
well, what I mean really is that when I look at the pre-war lives of people like my parents, and I think they were quite typical of people who lived in Europe before the war, whether it was Hungary or Poland or Ukraine or other countries, even Western Europe, their Jewish identity was formed informally for the most part. There were no day schools in Hungary. In smaller places, you didn't have yeshivas. Even where you had yeshivas, they were for the select few and for a limited period of time. There was no concept of universal day school education, where you spent half a day with secular studies and half a day with Jewish studies. It was something totally unknown. You had people who became Jewish professionals, Rabbanim and others, who had to obviously learn what they needed to know in order to do their jobs. But the amount of Jewish education that people by and large had was quite minimal. In my father's village, it was unthinkable to have any kind of Jewish school. There was a Malamed who came a couple of times a week. I doubt that he was very well educated himself in Jewish matters. He knew how to teach kids to make a bracha and how to read Hebrew and really the basics. And the rest was learned at home by example, by the children's parents. They lived Yiddishkeit at home, and that's what they learned, and that's what they were able to transmit. That was in a smaller place. In a larger community like Serenc, where my mother lived, there were many Jews living there, but there were no day schools. Day schools didn't exist until post-war America, and there were no yeshivas really. The young people, by and large, acquired a pretty pretty strong Jewish identity at home. As it happens, in the public schools in Hungary before the war, the religion was a required subject, and the Catholic and the Protestant students went to their classes at the appointed time, and the Jewish students went to their classes. My grandfather, my namesake, my mother's father, made his living by teaching Judaism in the public high school system. But there really wasn't very much in the way of formal education, and yet people were able to develop a strong Jewish identity. Today, there's an overwhelming emphasis placed on formal Jewish education, and there's the belief in many quarters that our salvation lies in Jewish education. That's what's going to preserve the identity of the young people and ensure the Jewish future. I'm not saying that we shouldn't have Jewish education. I'm just saying that perhaps we put too much faith in it. We rely on it too much and don't have a proper balance of emphasis on informal education in the home, which is the way that Jews always transmitted Jewish practice and Jewish values to their children.
And I would think that part of that's ironically and tragically because of the Holocaust, we've sort of lost that ability. The breakdown in tradition has sort of forced us to go into formal Jewish education, which, as you say, in many ways is very positive, but in other aspects is not such a positive type of a development.
Well, we have a tendency to romanticize the past, of course. The reality, to the extent that I'm aware of it, mainly from reading books, is that the breakdown was occurring, was well underway before the war. Even in Eastern Europe, which was the bastion of traditional Jewish learning and practice, the young people had other ideas. You can see this in the Molly Picon movies that were made in Warsaw on the eve of the Second World War, and a lot of the secular Yiddish literature of the time. There were problems then. Things weren't so perfect. And this was true in Hungary, too. My mother tells me that in the traditional Orthodox community that she lived in, the young people wanted to be modern. They wanted to be hip. And the most popular social event for the young people was the post-Yom Kippur ball, which the rabbi strongly disapproved of and tried to discourage to no avail. That was in a traditional community. So there was a process of disintegration that was already well underway. And yet, to the extent that Jews were able to preserve a strong Jewish identity, it was without the benefit of the kind of extensive network of Jewish educational institutions that we have today.
I'd venture to guess for a lot of people in the room, the most interesting and perhaps even troubling part of the book is where you talk about the issue of faith after the Holocaust. And this is where I really admire the honesty and the openness you bring to the book. In one passage, you mentioned how your father once mentioned that he lost his belief in a personal Mashiach, and that if the Mashiach didn't come in Auschwitz, he was never going to come. And while your father recognized this was, from the classical point of view, a heretical point of view, that's how he had to believe after what happened in Auschwitz. And I want you to develop this a little bit, just to how he felt about this and why the family came back to Orthodoxy. You discuss how basically everybody in the family became unobservant at a certain point in time, and eventually your part of the family came back to Orthodoxy. You're only a minor part of the people you knew. Most of the broader family did not come back to Orthodoxy. And one other aspect is, how did your parents, your father, want you to deal with issues of faith? He may have his own struggles because of what he went through, but how do he want you and family to deal with those issues of faith?
Well, it wasn't that he lost his faith in the coming of the Mashiach or anything else so much as a difficulty in reconciling what he knew he was supposed to believe with the practical reality that he saw out there in the world. The two just didn't fit together, and he was, a very intelligent person, not a learned one, because he didn't have the opportunity in the little village that he grew up in, but he was very bright, very sharp, and he learned in the best school, which is the school of life. He didn't know any chachmas. He knew what he saw, and what he saw didn't fit with what he knew he was supposed to believe. And I think that this was very common among survivors, the great majority of whom, sadly, were not able to reconnect to traditional Jewish faith, if they had it at all. Let's keep in mind that many people had lost it before the war. So it's not as if they lost it during the war. It wasn't there to begin with. Those who had it had the most fundamental shaking of their faith occurred during the war, which is perfectly understandable. How could you go through that kind of experience and not be shaken to the core? Here, too, you have to put it in a broader context. There's a process of disintegration of faith that had been going on since the beginning of the modern period, well preceded the Holocaust. The fact that the Holocaust happened in the middle of the 20th century certainly made it that much more difficult for people to find their way afterwards. A small minority did, but it's clear to me from my limited experience, and if anyone else out there has different experience, I defer to you. I'm not making any grandiose claims. I can only talk about that which I know. And this is what I know. This is what I see close at hand. It's inconceivable that someone could go through the horrific experiences that the survivors went through, and not be challenged in a very fundamental way. It would be inhuman for them not to. Anyone who promotes the myth, which we hear from time to time, especially among younger people who are disconnected from the events of the Holocaust, don't have a realistic understanding of what happened. The view that people had a simple faith and they came through the fire with their heads high, not turning to the right or to the left, is simply not true. Not only is it not true, but it does a serious injustice to those who had to struggle with issues of faith and who did find their way one way or the other. You're simply selling them short if you claim that they had that kind of simple faith. The only people who were capable of simple faith were simple people, and these were not simple people. These were very complex people who went through an awful lot. Now, how the people that turned out had a lot to do with all kinds of circumstances, including geography. Those who ended up in Toronto had a better chance than those who went to certain other places of reconnecting to their traditional past, because as the community in Toronto developed, it was a congenial environment for that to happen. People who went to other places, smaller places, didn't have that same opportunity or that same beneficial environment. Even within Toronto, people who found themselves in Scarborough, for example, had less prospect of reconnecting to their Jewish past than people who found themselves in North York. So it depended on a lot of things. Some people found their way, and some people didn't. The great majority did not. And those who did, no one can tell me that they went back to the way they were before the war as if nothing happened. It's just not realistic. It doesn't make any sense. And again, it does... It's a serious disservice to the survivors who had to struggle very hard to find their way back.
Was it ever talked about in the house? You're growing up issues of faith, and I mean, you even talk about your parents when the decision came whether you should go to a public school or a day school. That wasn't an easy decision, and I'm just wondering how that played into all of that. What they expected of you and what they wanted of you from a Jewish point of view, besides a strong Jewish identity. I'm talking about on a faith level, or it was a non-issue in the house.
Issues of faith are discussed by theologians and philosophers of religion.
Okay, no, that's fine.
That's not the kind of people we were at home. We were regular folks, and these things didn't come up. I developed an interest in such questions later on, but didn't come from the home, not in any direct sense anyway. You just lived your life, and it was a visceral kind of thing. It came from the gut, and you did what felt right. You didn't think it through in a cerebral way. It's just not the way it happened.
Okay. You mentioned that you grew up in depending on from a geographical point of view, had a big impact. It was sort of implied in the book that the cousins, the family that ended up in Israel, unfortunately, actually were part of the group that did not find their way back. And you also mentioned in the book the issue how the myth that you discovered of why the family moved to Canada and not to Israel. I just wonder if you can talk about how you felt about that when you found out about why the family actually ended up in Canada and not in Israel, and you can just maybe spend a little bit on that.
Well, there are two things that are not quite so black and white. There were some relatives in Israel who were and still are religious, even extremely religious, the majority not so. the family in Toronto found their way to a pretty high degree of religious observance, but not everybody. There were some who didn't. It's mixed. Overall, I would say that the family in Toronto is more religious than the family in Israel. Why that's so, again, as I mentioned before, it's a whole welter of circumstances that come into play. In the case of Israel, of course, in the early days, there was a very strong trend toward rejection, not only of traditional Judaism, but of the traditional, Golis Jew. There was a very ideologically driven attempt to create a new Jew in the new state of Israel, and a rejection of Jewish tradition was an integral part of this. And young people who found themselves in Israel in the early days, for the most part, were swept up by this. There wasn't the same kind of ideological animus here in Toronto or in other diaspora communities. So I think that made a big difference.
Your father merited to see to attend the wedding of your child, of your eldest, to attend the wedding of the grandchild. You describe what an unbelievable thing that survivors to actually attend the wedding of a grandchild. And your mother, I'm just like amazed, looking at her now, how well she looks. She just had a major birthday, if I can say so. I won't say what number, but if you read the book, you can figure it out. But really, she looks amazing, and her constant smile. And I just want you to describe how their positive outlook on life, and maybe even the longevity in years that they've been blessed with, how that relates to how they put the Holocaust in perspective as well as possible, and how they viewed, moving forward, the optimistic version of life.
It's pretty clear to me that people who were able to find their way back to some kind of faith, some kind of grounding in the past and the Jewish past and the tradition, something that anchored them to their families in the pre-war Europe, people who were able to do that, I think, had a significant advantage in coping with the challenges of their new lives and putting all the pieces together. When you compare to people who didn't have that, it's not altogether straightforward. There were people who totally lost their faith and yet were able to become very successful individuals after the war. But those who were anchored in something, I think, had an easier time of it. And again, it wasn't something that was premeditated, something that was thought out. There was no game plan. And there was the daily challenge of living life and, finding their way in a new country and, making a living and raising a family. And they just sort of improvised as they went along, and nobody could possibly predict where things would end up. It's just that in their case, this is the way things unfolded. But after the fact, looking back at it, it was clearly, as far as I'm concerned, a benefit that they were able to find this anchor in their lives.
How was the writing and the research done in the book? And it's an extremely well, researched work from an Italian history point of view alone. But how did the writing of the book impact on your view of your parents? If it changed at all over the 8 years of the writing of the book?
Well, I came to have a much more critical understanding of things, which is what always happens when you start to dig and learn about things in greater depth. When you have one source of information, you rely on that and you accept it uncritically. When you have multiple sources of information, you find contradictions which challenge you to do deeper analysis and figure out what it was that really happened. And you even find yourself asking whether it really mattered what really happened. In the process of researching the book and writing it, I learned a great deal, and my understanding of my parents' past and the process of healing and regeneration that they went through after the war became much more complex than it had been when I was a child. Part of that has to do with growing up and seeing things in a more subtle, more nuanced way. That happens anyway as you get older. But that in combination with all kinds of interesting things that I learned along the way, which I think are pretty well chronicled in the book, which I urge you all to read if you haven't done so already, I think that that made a difference for sure to my understanding of my parents.
I can ask your parents, what about on your children and the grandchildren even? What is the impact? How do they feel about the book? How has that been impacted, or have they said anything?
Well, as far as I'm concerned, the book is primarily for them, for my wonderful children and grandchildren, and I hope that this will be a permanent legacy, a record for them, so they will always know and always remember what their ancestors, Bill and Judith Rubenstein, what kind of people they were, and what they went through, and what kind of lives they lived. It's mainly for them. I hope that other people will be able to benefit from the book as well. My kids have been very, very supportive throughout, which of course I find deeply gratifying and not at all surprising, really. It's not as if they were ignorant about the war years before I sat down to write a book. They got the stories from my mother, and also from my dear mother-in-law, who was the same age as my mother, living now with us in Toronto. And coincidentally, or perhaps not so coincidentally, although we didn't realize it at the time we were recording, both Renee's mother and mine were in Auschwitz at exactly the same time. So we have that in common, and they're both great talkers. They're both great storytellers with very different perspectives, being very different people from one another. But our children got the stories of the war years from both of the grandmothers.
Thank you very much. I want to open up the floor if anybody has any questions. And I think there's a mic here. I don't know where it went. If you could come up to the mic, sir. And we'll take a few questions. If you can keep them you know, brief and to the point, that'd be greatly appreciated. The mic is coming. They turn it off, so use this.
About growing up in Toronto and how it affected you and your family. Okay, and I hope you'll spend a decent amount of time on that, because you haven't spent any time on it at all yet. So
part
far.
Of it is in the book, and it's really a book. If I can answer for Ellie, which maybe isn't right, but it's a book about his. When I asked Ellie, a couple of the questions in advance, he said he really doesn't want to talk about himself. He wants to talk about his parents. And anything about himself is obviously as a child of his parents. When you write about your parents, you're writing on yourself too. But it's really, I think it's a testament to his parents and the children and the grandchildren. He is the link, I think, between the parents and the children. And I think that's a beautiful legacy. Any questions, huh? Yeah, I'm sorry. I don't want to speak for you.
That notwithstanding, I would like to say a little bit about growing up in Toronto. I think those of us who were privileged to grow up in this city really had something special. Toronto, at the end of the Second World War, was a city poised for dramatic growth. And we all know what's been going on in the city in the last few decades. It was a place of endless opportunity for our parents who came here and were able to find all kinds of good things to do, which wasn't necessarily the case in other more settled, less dynamic places. In Jewish terms, there was certainly an established Jewish community, but there wasn't all that much going on. And I think in Toronto, more than pretty well anywhere else in the world, outside of Israel, the survivors who came here were able to have a huge impact on the existing Jewish community. And Toronto has been totally transformed. Not all the credit goes to the post-war immigrants, but a very a large part of it does, I believe. And so, to be a child growing up in the post-war years in Toronto, I think was very special, because there were so many of us who were of the same background. And we didn't think about it then. There wasn't a sense of kinship among us, as I mentioned in the book. That didn't happen really until the mid-70s when Helen Epstein wrote her groundbreaking book, Children of the Holocaust, which my sister Rochelle and I were part of. But until then, there was no sense of the second generation or children of survivors being a distinct group with specific characteristics. And yet, looking back, there was something special about it, and Toronto was a place where there was really a very fertile ground, a very congenial environment for growing up as a child of survivors.
Any questions? In the back? No? Yes. Loud, please. Or if you come, okay. Can you come up to the mic, please?
Sure.
Now it's working out.
It was mentioned a couple of times that your parents were more their success here was surpassed their wildest dreams. I was wondering if you'd elaborate on. I'm personally, my grandparents, they were of the age, they were in Canada fortunately before the Holocaust. My family came over in the teens, and wondering, there are many examples of people of survivors who were very successful after coming over after the war. If you care to elaborate at all on why you think specifically your family or generally many Holocaust survivors were able to be more successful than those who stayed here or who were here before?
Well, I don't know if I have anything particularly original to say about it. It's been often observed that there was some kind of process of natural selection. The people who did survive the war often, not always, because there was such a thing as muzzle, but very often had an inner strength that enabled them to deal with the challenges that were hurled at them. And so after what they went through, living in a normal place where they had the ability to live in dignity and to work to support themselves, that was something that they welcomed with great enthusiasm, and it's exactly what they had dreamed of for all those years. And so when they had the opportunity, they knew what to do about it. It needs to be pointed out to keep things in proper perspective. This needs to be emphasized that tragically not everyone was successful that way. There are people who survived the war and one way or the other just fell to pieces or managed to plod along but did not have successful lives. sometimes even when they were materially successful, they were emotionally troubled or just very unhappy or very miserable people. There was a lot of dysfunction, and it's a sad reality. It's inevitable. You know, as strong as people might have been to survive the war, there were consequences, there were after effects, and sometimes they didn't reveal themselves right away. When you're young and strong and resilient, you can cope with a great deal. As you get older and your defenses are not as good, there's the possibility of being overwhelmed, and you see that in a good number of cases. It's quite sad to see that, you know, people who did cope and who built successful lives encountered a great difficulty when they reached a certain age.
Okay, yes.
Well, I think that's something that you find everywhere in the world. Unfortunately, it doesn't have to do with the geography nearly as much as it has to do with human nature. I think there's a universal human tendency to be snobbish toward outsiders, toward newcomers. You find this everywhere. People who are the old-timers, who are well-established, don't have any need for newcomers. They're doing just fine without them. Sometimes there's fear or suspicion or worry that they're going to try to leech on them. There's this hostility that I know existed to some degree in Toronto, as apparently it did in Montreal and in other places. I think there was probably less of it in places where there were there was a larger proportion of newcomers relative to old-timers. I would think that in some of the large, well-established Jewish communities in the United States, you know, the old cities where Jews had been living for 10 generations or more, and where the post-war arrivals were a small minority, I would think that the rate of social acceptance was quite a bit lower. In a place like Toronto, where there was a large number of newcomers relative to old timers, I think it was probably easier. But you see this everywhere. You had it even in Israel, which was a brand new country, where everybody was a newcomer. The Chalutzim were there for a couple of generations longer, but how long was anybody there? I mean, are the people who could trace their lineage back to ancient times, or, you know, just a family or two in total. But even in Israel, you had this kind of resistance against newcomers by the old-timers. And you see it to this day, and you know, it's quite shameful in some cases, and it even smacks of racism with regard to certain Jewish groups that have arrived in Israel more recently, where you hear some really ugly sentiments expressed, which are not worthy of Jews, given our historical experience with persecution and discrimination. But human nature tends to get in the way. Are we better than anybody else? We would like to think that we've learned something from our historical experience. I'd like to think that we've been sensitized toward this sort of thing by what we've gone through. But unfortunately, it's not necessarily the case. And despite everything, people are people, after all.
Okay, last question. Yes.
I understand that you wrote this book as a tribute to your parents, but was that the main catalyst or inspiration to write this book, just as a tribute, or was there something that sparked this years before that you wanted to do this story?
Well, I would like to think that the conclusions I draw in the book go beyond being just a tribute to my parents. It certainly is that, but I'd like to think it's more than that. I hope that it teaches us something about the capabilities of human beings, the ability to overcome very bad situations, to recover faith and resilience and go on with life when it seems that all is black and there's no hope for human beings. I tried hard to convey those messages, and I hope that to some extent I've succeeded.
I can say you have, and it was really a very inspiring work, you know, book when I read it, and I really urge you, and I think, you know, you've captured the key messages, and it's an optimistic book, and I think that's a beautiful tribute, and I think you've done a wonderful job, and we should not have to face these, like, you know, problems again. We should be able to discuss, you know, books with only a cheerful disposition. But, you know, thank you very much for writing the book and for talking with us. Okay, thank you very much. And you can look on the tables for all our upcoming programs this week and next. We've got lots of stuff going on. Just a short plug.
We hope you found this recording a most enjoyable learning experience. We welcome your feedback. Please contact us at info@torahinmotion.org or at www.torahinmotion.org. Have a great day. Thank you.